and welcome to the MDS podcast, the podcast channel of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Tiago Otairu, a professor at the University Medical Center Göttingen in Germany, and today I have the pleasure to interview Professor William Langston, clinical professor of neurology and neuroscience and pathology from Stanford University in the US. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us on this MDS podcast. We are here today to talk about a historical discovery more than 30 years ago that had tremendous impact in our understanding and study of Parkinson's disease. And so we are really very excited to hear this story in the first person from you. So can you tell us the story of MPTP?
Well, it's going to be challenging in a short period of time. It is a true medical detective story. It's a lot of fun to read if you ever want to read my book, The Case of the Frozen Addicts. But it started with a clinical observation, and I like to point out that even to this day, clinical observations are huge in medical discovery. Never assume when you see an unusual case that you are not seeing something new. Follow it through and be curious. In this case, it was a patient who entered Valley Medical Center where I was attending. And there was an argument between the psychiatry staff and the neurology staff. The neurology staff thought this particular patient was catatonic schizophrenic. The psychiatrist thought he was neurologic, and I got called down to mediate. It took me about 30 seconds to figure it out. This catatonic schizophrenic, quote, had cogwheel rigidity, a classic sign of Parkinson's. And I'd examined catatonics before. You feel an active resistance to them, not this cogwheel. So immediately we knew this amazing case was neurologic. Then the hard part started. Why? Come over a couple of days, time, it was absolutely indistinguishable for typical PD, how this patient was only 43, and as I said, come on, over days. So we found out he had a girlfriend, and later it turned out she had the same thing. We thought maybe carbon monoxide in the house, that kind of thing. That turned out not to be the case. And then we found some cases in Santa Cruz, that's a place about 30 miles from us, who also had it. The only common link was they were all heroin abusers. So then our chase started in that direction. We went out with police raids. We got different samples trying to analyze this thing. And it was quite a harrowing story, actually. The break in the case came when we learned of a case at NIH where a young man had been making his own synthetic heroin. The investigators at NIH had tried to figure the case out. They had samples, they'd done analyses, but they never figured out the answer. And a crime lab technician put me onto this paper, but it was about 15 years old. So I called that lab, this is after a lot of work, I called that lab and said, we had the atomic number from study, but we didn't know the context. But I said, you have several metabolites here, you have the original compound. Did any of them cause this? And they said, no, everything we tried failed. That's what we gave up. They never figured it out. And using the atomic number, I said, this compound on the far right, metabolite, which is now called MPTP, has the exact atomic weight of what we're looking at. He said, bingo, I've got it. He said, that's the only one we didn't try. Oh my God, we solved the mystery. Yeah. 22, they were very misled because these other were narcotics. And when you give a rat a narcotic like heroin, they freeze up and become a catatonic. So it looked just like what they saw in the patients, and they kept chasing it. Turns out it's well known if you give an opiate to a rat, it develops what's teasingly called ratatonia. And they totally misled them. So we respected another analysis, and we had it. We finally had what it was. And that changed history. It led to the first true model of Parkinson's. I always thought we don't have a good model of Parkinson's. In fact, a very simple compound similar to paraquat in the environment could have been an environmental toxin. And it was a magnificent tool to study Nigel cell degeneration. This compound goes right in blood, through the blood-brain barrier, right to the Nigra and knocks it out. Amazing compound. It's been used for all types of studies of all aspects of PD. It all started with that one patient who either was starting to have catatonic schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's really amazing and unbelievable. So just out of curiosity, were those people that were affected, were they using together, or was this just a coincidence as well?
They were not using together. The way we really found the key in the story was I had a fellow who lived in Santa Cruz. We had two cases. We thought maybe it's just in the environment. I mean, in the home, something in the home, because they lived together. He was having dinner with a neurologist from Watsonville, that's further south. This neurologist, totally unattached to any of this, said, I had these two weird cases. They're two brothers, and they just froze up like a pillar of salt. And my fellow, who knew our cases, said, oh my God, it sounds the same. We got down there, examined them. It was the only connection was heroin abuse. If they had all been together, we would have still been searching for something in the environment, as I said, like carbon monoxide or something like that, or eating something. But the fact those cases were totally unassociated, we had that common link. And so we had, that was one step in this investigation.
Yeah. And like you said, so MPTP causes Parkinsonism, which manifests with similar symptoms to Parkinson's, but it's not, of course, Parkinson's disease. So this is an important concept to leave here, because people sometimes think that when they use MPTP in mice or in the lab, they are modeling Parkinson's. They are modeling Parkinsonism. So I think this is an important concept. And out of curiosity, did those patients respond to levodopa and to other typical PD therapies, or are there differences? Did you see any differences at that level as well?
That's a great question. We had some debate over that. Clinically, it looked identical to Parkinson's. The patients were severely disabled, even had trouble eating. And actually, I'm not sure they would have survived very long. So based on that, looked like Parkinson's. Patients needed it. We gave them levodopa. 3 hours later, they were up walking around in normal. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Awakenings, but I think who's the actor that played the patient. They showed that they gave him levodopa in the Awakenings. He'd been in, like, catatonic, basically, for 30 years. And when they came back, the bed was empty. And he was out walking around. And the movie critic said, oh, that's ridiculous. That's just Hollywood. Nope. Absolutely.
That was reality. Yeah.
It worked. It worked.
And this Parkinsonian state, So it responded to levodopa, but did it improve with time, or did it stay? Was it a permanent damage that the patients had?
That's a really good question. They had a lot of side effects, including hallucinations, and not all of them. And I really wonder the brain that's been getting a lot of major league drugs, just like Parkinson's, levodopa can induce hallucinations. And they were young, and several of them developed very severe dyskinesias. And that's, in my opinion, typical of young. They get it much quicker and earlier. One patient got dyskinesias within 3 weeks, which you don't usually think of with typical PD. Actually, that was depicted in The Awakenings, too. So there are lots of complications. And the last thing is, I have to tell this tongue-in-cheek, a goal in medicine is usually to get a person back where they can resume their normal life. That first patient was a drug dealer and junkie. And we actually returned him to selling drugs.
Yeah.
I don't think he used them again. And boy, he got in all kinds of trouble. And I think at one point some gang took him out. So he was back to his normal life, but that wasn't necessarily a good thing. Others lived longer, but again, had problems with side effects, not using their drugs correctly, et cetera. One patient was in a New England Journal. sent one patient to Sweden for an embryonic cell transplant. That did help for a while, but eventually it didn't. She wound up terribly disabled and eventually died years later. It's really, I'm writing this up right now. On the other hand, one patient who we had to get him out of jail had two state troopers in the hospital room with him. We did deep brain stimulation. He did great. He just died of liver cancer about 6 months ago. So it's a single nigral lesion, and that's what DBS does.
Yeah.
And it's a real interesting comparison between cell transplantation, which they're trying again right now. We've tried 30 years ago and failed. And DBS, it's a one in one, but one failed, it didn't work. And the DBS in the other one had DBS. Pretty much he had assisted living, but he lived a pretty good life. So I think it's a very interesting comparison. We're going to write the two cases up.
Yeah, absolutely. And did any of those people come to autopsy? And do you know if their brains showed Lewy body pathology?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer is no.
So no pathology.
No pathology. In monkeys, we saw something that looked a little like Lewy bodies. And we saw it in the paramygdala nucleus. And it turns out, very often you see concurrent Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And in those cases, lots of Lewy bodies in that area. But we were never able to convincingly prove we had Lewy bodies. I think that we had a few cases where it was close, but never could. It's more like Park 2, which is pretty much, in some most cases, just the nigrum.
Yeah, so it suggests that maybe when it's such an aggressive damage, maybe there's not enough time to form the mature Lewy bodies that would normally take decades to form.
And then except for the one who had DBS lived long enough. That's a very good point. Unfortunately, he died. I was out of town, and we were not able to get the brain, but that would have been an incredible case to examine.
Wow, so this is very interesting. I think, of course, people have to go and read your book to understand all the little details that I'm sure would make it even more interesting. In the interest of time for our listeners, are there any other interesting facts, anecdotes that you could share related to this historical finding?
There are just so many. I guess here's an anecdote. One of our patients had severe tremor and went to a major university hospital. And they filmed him as a case of phenocyanine toxicity, a bed tremor. And I actually got the video. It was in their teaching library. And they said, this is a case of phenocyanine toxicity. You can see it causes full-blown Parkinson's, severe tremor as a teaching case. The only problem was he'd never been exposed to phenocyanine. Minor glitch. And I guess there's this tendency this day, you think everything that's ever out there has been seen. So we always want to ratchet it into the wrong size hole. In this case, new phenocyanine toxicity, not unlikely he might have gotten it. And they pushed it in, and that was before any of my cases, and he got discharged. Yeah. And in the teaching library to this day.
Very
so I think there's a lot of lessons at that level to be learned.
Yeah. Bill, thank you so much. It has been very nice listening to this brief and short version of the full story. But I hope this is enough to entice our listeners to go and read your book about this finding. So thank you so much for participating in the podcast.
My pleasure.
So we've interviewed Professor William Langston on the historical discovery of MPTP as a toxin causing Parkinsonism back in the early 80s. I thank you all for listening, and I invite you to join us in our upcoming podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.